Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Rock Review. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about rock and roll music from such sources as the News and Observer, The Week magazine, The Independent, New York Times, ClassicRock.about.com, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly.
I've been in the right place, but it must have been the wrong time. My head is in a bad place, but I'm having such a good time.
This opening is brought to us by an artist named Dr. John. Right place, wrong time. We're going to be hearing more about and from Dr. John later on in today's program, and he will close out today's program as well.
But it must have been the right time. I've been in the right place. But it must have been the wrong song.
But first, these trivia questions. Our trivia questions come to us once again from ClassicBands.com, from their series called Who Sang That? So I'll give you the name of the song. You tell me who sang it. Bad Girls. Who sang that? It reached all the way up to number one back in 1979. Who sang Bad Girls in 1979? The second song is entitled Because. Who sang that one? That one got all the way up to number three back in 1964. Because. Big hint.
It's right that I should care about you.
Because. Who sang it? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Transition section of today's program is brought to us once again by BGORecords.com. Today in rock history. And today is the weekend of August 27th through the 29th. What were the number one hits in history this weekend? Well, back in 1968, it was the Beach Boys with Do It Again. And back in 1981, it was ELO with Time. And back in 1987, the number one hit this weekend was Los Lobos, La Bamba. Now, if you were born on August 27th, you share a birthday with B.J. Thomas. Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head. He was born on August 27th, 1942. If you're born on the 28th, you share a birthday with Shania Twain. She was born on that day in 1955. And Leanne Rimes, she was born on that day back in 1982. Now, if you're born on August 29th, you share a birthday with Michael Jackson. He was born on that day back in 1958. Thriller. Deaths on August 27th include Brian Epstein. He was the Beatles' manager. He died on August 27, 1967. And Stevie Ray Vaughan, who died 20 years ago this weekend. Miscellany in rock history this weekend. Well, back in 1954, Elvis Presley enters the U.S. territorial bestsellers chart. Memphis Area returns at number three with Blue Moon of Kentucky. It was the B-side of That's All Right, his first ever chart entry. It was 52 years ago this weekend that George Harrison joined Paul McCartney and John Lennon in The Quarrymen. And back in 1958 this weekend, Alan Freed's Big Beat Show opens at Brooklyn's Fox Theater, a change of venue following the summer rock and roll riots. Frankie Avalon, Bill Haley, and Chuck Berry share the bill. Back in 1961 this weekend, the Marvelettes release Please Mr. Postman in the U.S., the first Motown chart topper. Back in 1963, Mahalia Jackson, Bob Dylan, and Joan Baez play as Martin Luther King delivers his I Have a Dream speech in Washington, D.C. And finally, back in 1965, Bob Dylan was booed off stage at Forest Hill Stadium, New York, for playing an electric guitar. ¶¶
the still of the night, in the world's ancient light, where wisdom roams up.
In local rock news, we see this article published at www.nasher.duke.edu on August the 1st, 2010. A new exhibit is about to open at the Nasher Museum of Art at Duke University. It will run from September 2, 2010 to February 6, 2011. It's entitled The Record, Contemporary Art and Vinyl. The Nasher Museum of Art at Duke University presents a groundbreaking exhibition that explores the culture of vinyl records through 50 years of contemporary art. The Record, Contemporary Art and Vinyl, features work by 41 artists from around the world, from the 1960s to the present, who use vinyl records as subject or medium. The exhibition includes sound work, sculpture installation, drawing, painting, photography, video, and performance. The article skips down. The exhibition includes a broad range of works such as hybrid violin and record player, a Viophonograph, a seminal work by Laurie Anderson, David Byrne's original life-size Polaroid photo montage used for the cover of the 1978 Talking Heads album, more songs about buildings and food, a monumental column of vinyl records by Cordova, and an important early work by Rob Leto, who transformed Billie Holiday records in an alchemic process to create hand-painted buttons. Works by Christian Marclay, who has made art with records for 30 years, include his early and rarely seen recycled records, as well as his most recent record video, Looking for Love. The Nasher Museum commissioned two works for the record. Berlin-based artist Satch Hoyt created a 16-foot canoe made of red 45 RPM records with an original soundscape during a 2009 artist residency at Duke. New York artist Xavier Simmons created photographs of the North Carolina landscape and solicited musical responses from musicians such as Mac McConaughey of Superchunk, Tunde Adebimpe of TV on the Radio, and Jim James of My Morning Jacket. The original songs will be pressed onto a 12-inch record and played with her installation. The article skips down. The accompanying cover-to-cover installation features 10 artists and musicians who each curated a crate of 20 albums that tell a story through cover visuals. Visitors will peruse the crates with headphones, listen to records on record players. The article then ends with this. Since the heyday of vinyl and through its decline and recent resurgence, a surprising number of artists have worked with vinyl records. The record presents some of the best, rarest, and most unexpected examples. The artists in the exhibition used the vinyl records as metaphor, archive, artifact, icon, portrait, or transcendent medium.
We don't need no education.
This next article comes to us from the Wall Street Journal by Eric Felton, published on the August 6, 2010, entitled, Why Dictators Hate to See Us Moved by Music. Iran's ultimate supremo, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, gave a remarkable endorsement to music this week, declaring it not compatible with the highest values of the sacred regime of the Islamic Republic. He didn't exactly mean to praise song, but if music is a threat to the sort of murderous theocracy over which Mr. Khamenei presides, well then, here's to music. The Ayatollah didn't just denounce Western music, which he has done before, but music making of any and every sort. Instead of wasting time practicing scales, he declared, it's better that our dear youth spend their valuable time in learning science and essential and useful skills. The kind of enrichment he's interested in isn't the sort you get in the concert hall. Though the lament is framed by as a concern about youngsters frittering away their precious time, I suspect Mr. Khamenei's real complaint is rooted in the same disquiet authoritarians have long felt about music, that it affects people profoundly and cannot be controlled. There's no doubt that music affects us, perhaps in surprising ways. A new study published in a journal called The Arts in Psychotherapy tested which was more effective in treating mild depression, reclining on a sofa talking to a psychiatrist or simply listening to Bach, Corelli, and Mozart. Few of the patients involved, who were drawn from a clinic in Mexico, were initially interested in spending any time with old Wolfgang Amadeus, but in the end they not only came to enjoy the experience, but benefited from it. The overwhelming majority of the patients listening to classical music reported feeling better 2 months into the therapy. Not even half of those getting traditional tell-me-about-that psychotherapy saw any improvement whatsoever. In an effort to explain these results, the researchers surmise that listening, at least to music with structure and challenging complexity, facilitates brain development and/or plasticity. It might have helped in treating depression that the patients weren't given a cheerful earful Bach's Italian Concerto as opposed to, say, Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings. Just how directly can music manipulate our emotions and even our actions? The website of the science magazine Miller McCune has been gathering up recent research attempting to demonstrate that music is instrumental. There is a French study just out from the journal Psychology of Music showing that young ladies are more willing to give out their phone numbers after listening to romantic tunes. The young ladies exposed to neutral compositions were less open to propositions. This follows on a study done last year showing that men buy more roses when a florist pipes in love songs. Also from France comes a study published in the International Journal of Hospitality Management suggesting that if a restaurant plays an emphatic, empathetic soundtrack stacked with pro-social ditties, customers tend to tip better. These represent a modern behavioral science version of John Dryden's bold declaration, "What passion cannot music raise and quell?" All of which suggest we would be wise to be wary of music's sucker bait that it is. But if music is such an effective tool for manipulating people, why isn't it wholeheartedly embraced by the tyrants in Tehran? Where would the manipulative arts be without incidental music to give the consumer a shove, whether it's the anxious undercurrent reality TV uses in the tense build-up to sending someone home, the ominous serial killer chords employed by slasher flicks and political attack ads, or the achingly mournful indie rock that Grey's Anatomy relies on every week to make its viewers reach for the third Kleenex? What propagandist would pass up such power? The rub is that, though music may be controlling, it isn't controllable. Even the honest artist looking only to achieve an immediate effect in his audience can't know just what it is that any one person is feeling. The article skips down. What is it anyway to feel a response to music? We all have the experience, but it remains something of a mystery. In the new book, The Music Instinct, How Music Works and Why We Can't Do Without It, Philip Ball notes, very often we may recognize music as having a particular emotional quality without it actually awakening that emotion in us. If we do have some visceral emotive response to a song, it may not have that much to do with the music itself. The emotions triggered by hearing the song you dance to at your wedding are likely to depend on whether your marriage is still intact. This poses problems for the propagandist who can't count on his patriotic anthem not to curdle in the ears of abused people trying to divorce themselves from the state. For all the problems with music in our time, cookie-cut karaoke pop, sterile atonal highbrow modernity, singing competitions, Justin Bieber, auto-tune, the art still somehow manages to make despots nervous. That calls for a fanfare. This next article comes to us from Entertainment Weekly, published on the 30th of July, 2010, entitled, Amy Adams Lands Janis Joplin Role But will the movie ever happen? Amy Adams' reps have confirmed that the 35-year-old actress plans to play Janis Joplin in a biopic called Get It While You Can, but she might want to hold off on singing lessons. She's just the latest in a string of stars who have signed on to play the rock icon over the past decade. None of the rest have seen their projects make it to production. This time around may be less daunting. Director Fernando Morelli's City of God is set to direct, and Fox Searchlight may come on to distribute. Morelli's is due to direct another job first, but if that doesn't come through, he could be filming Adams as the late singer before the year is up. We've seen all this before, of course, but let's hope this time we get to watch someone singing the blues. It's interesting to note that four others besides Amy Adams have been scheduled to play Joplin since 1999, including Renee Zellweger and Pink. So what do you know about today's featured artist, Dr. John? Well, according to this Rolling Stone Encyclopedia 2001 article, combining New Orleans funk, glitter, and voodoo charm, pianist Dr. John was an energetic frontman in the early 1970s, Right Place, Wrong Time, which opened today's program, by the way, and a behind-the-scenes mover before and since. Reben Neck got his first taste of showbiz through his mother, a model who got young Malcolm's face on ivory soap boxes. His father ran a record store. By his early teens, he was an accomplished pianist and guitarist. From hanging around his dad's store and at Cosimo Matassa's studio, he got to know local musicians. By the mid-1950s, he was doing session work with Professor Longhair, Frankie Ford, and Joe Tex. He also helped form the Black Artist Cooperative, AFO, All for One Records, and he was the first white man on that roster. By the start of the 60s, he had graduated to producing and arranging sessions for others, Lee Allen, Red Tyler, Earl Palmer, and recording some on his own, notably 1959 Storm Warning on Rex Records. Rebinac's reputation was based on his guitar and keyboard playing, but a hand wound suffered in a 1961 barroom gunfight forced him to take up bass with the Dixieland Band.
Such a night. Sweet confusion under the moonlight. Such a night.
In the mid-1960s, Rebinac moved to L.A. and became a session regularly, notably for producer Phil Spector. He played in various unsuccessful, wildly named bands like the Zuzu Band with Jesse Hill and Morgus and the Three Ghouls. He also devoted an interest in voodoo, to which he had been introduced by a mystical voodoo artist named Prince Lala in the 1950s at AFO. In 1968, Rebinac unveiled his new public persona of Dr. John Crew, the Night Tripper, later shortened to Dr. John.
If I don't do it, you know somebody else will. If I don't do it, you know somebody else will. If I don't do it,
as indicated by some of his song titles, I Walk on Gilded Splinters, Gris Gris Gumbo Yaya, Croaker Court Bouillon, it was a brew of traditional Creole chants, mystical imagery, and traces of psychedelia, an influence underscored by Rebinac's onstage wardrobe, brightly colored robes, feathered headdresses, and a Mardi Gras-style retinue of dancers and singers. Dr. John slowly acquired a loyal cult following, including Eric Clapton and Mick Jagger, who played on The Sun, Moon, and Herbs. He moved to the more accessible regions of funk on In the Right Place, which reached number 24 as an album back in 1973. Right Place, Wrong Time, reached number 9. That was his biggest hit, followed a few months later by Such a Night, number 42, which we just heard. In 1973, he appeared in the band's 1978 farewell concert film, The Last Waltz, and in 1981, he released the first of several solo piano LPs. Dr. John plays Mac Rebennack, i.e., plays himself. In late 1980s, Dr. John began reaching back to his New Orleans roots, while more subtly mainstreaming his appeal. His 1989 In a Sentimental Mood collected old blues and saloon standards and earned him his first Grammy for his duet with Ricky Lee Jones on Making Whoopee.
Oh, Making Whoopee.
Going back to New Orleans with a cast of New Orleans All-Stars featuring Al Hurt, Pete Fontaine, Danny Barker, Alvin Red Tyler, and the Neville Brothers won him another Grammy. By that time, his gruffy baritone voice had become familiar to millions through a succession of TV commercial jingles. In 1991, rap group PM Don sampled from one of Dr. John's oldest tracks, I Walk on Gilded Splinters. 2 years later, Beck sampled the same track for his folk rap slacker anthem, Loser. In 1993, Dr. John published his autobiography, Under a Hoodoo Moon.
Sometimes you treat me fine, then you get way out of line. Still in all, I'm sticking like glue. I know what I've got, but I don't know what I'm getting.
And from VH1.com, we see this little piece here. Sipiana Hurricane, a four-song EP celebrating his beloved hometown of New Orleans in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, arrived in November of 2005. Mercenary, an album of covers of songs made famous by Johnny Mercer, appeared on Blue Note in 2006. City That Care Forgot followed in 2008. The Night Tripper persona was revived for 2010's Tribal, which featured guest spots from Derek Trucks, Alan Toussaint, Donald Harrison, and the late Bobby Charles.
I so need a nurse. I know that I can't do any better, but believe me, I could do a whole lot worse.
Dr. John. He'll close out today's program as well with Feel Good Music. But first, this article. Entitled, Robert Plant Gets to the Roots. This was published in NewsObserver.com back on August the 2nd, 2010. The fact is difficult to grasp, but Robert Plant has been a solo artist for much longer than he was the lead singer and strutting rock and roll god of Led Zeppelin. Those trips for millions of fans up that stairway to heaven lasted from 1968 to 1980. In the 30 years since, Plant, now a grizzled and amused 61, has found new adventures and a new identity and a path to musical heaven in American blues, folk, and roots music. But he remains patient with those confused by the contrast between his towering historical image and musical present. That's all right. It's been a great run, Plant says, from his Phoenix stop of a tour and his latest project, Band of Joy. If we can't have fun now, the game's over, isn't it? The last time Plant played Phoenix some 40 years ago, he had some fun spraying fire extinguisher foam under the door of sleeping Led Zeppelin guitarist Jimmy Page's hotel room. Such memories can make touring a little bit like being in a time tunnel, Plant muses, but he has looked for mellower forms of enjoyment since Led Zeppelin split, blown apart after drummer John Bonham fell asleep drunk and suffocated on his vomit, an emblem of the dangers of rock and roll excess. These days, Plant regards his reign atop the rock pantheon with a cynical eye. "I know exactly which buttons to press to make all that come back," he says. "Sometimes I get the old metal polish out and polish up bits of gold, but not often." He doesn't need to indulge in nostalgia. "I'm singing better now than I have in a lifetime," he says, "and I'm not standing on top of a barrel hopping up and down with a chain around my neck, as if he's 17 again." Band of Joy was the name of the psychedelic blues band fronted by a teenage Plant, just before Yardbirds guitarist Page scooped him up for Led Zeppelin. Its current incarnation, which includes Nashville luminaries guitarist-producer Buddy Miller and singer Patty Griffin, plays startlingly diverse music ranging from obscure gospel, soul, folk, and blues to more contemporary songs by Los Lobos, Townes Van Zandt, alt-rock group Low, and even Plant and Page. The group's eponymous release debuts in September. "You can get so easily typecast," Plant says. "You can find routines and formulas that you drop into, and you say, 'Hey, this is my style.' I think back on the days of Band of Joy. We were finding a brand new place to be coming from, that kind of English psychedelic blues idiom, at the expense of popularity and success. And I see that. What I do now is I stimulate myself by being in great environments at the cost and at the joy of moving away from being typecast and continuing to open my repertoire and using my gift just like I was doing when I was 17. The article skips down and ends with this: "With Band of Joy, he's reaching even deeper into U.S. traditions, finding roots in Europe, Latin America, and beyond, still enthralled by the wild sounds from across the pond." So how'd you do on the trivia questions for today? The first question was the song Bad Girls, which reached number one back in 1979. Question was, who sang that? That was, of course, Donna Summer. Second question, given the big hint of the soundtrack I played for you, who sang Because, which reached number three back in 1964? That was, of course, the Dave Clark Five.
I'm a feel-good doctor and I don't lose. Make you feel good and you won't refuse. I'm the one who's gonna change.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Rock Review. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long, until next time.
So can we. You can do it better. You got to prove it by me.